Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, November 13, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll be discussing the North Korea conundrum, sanctions, leverage, balancing power, and rumors of war. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Mr. Daniel Blumenthal, Director of Asian Studies and Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Professor Stefan Haggard, Lawrence and Sally Krause, Professor of Korea-Pacific Studies at the School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego, Professor Julian Koo, Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, Faculty Director of International Programs, and Morris A. Dean, Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Law at Hofstra School of Law. And finally, our moderator, Bruce Klinger, Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. I will turn it over to Bruce to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Bruce. The floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much, and welcome to everyone who's online here. So we're looking forward to a good discussion. All three of our panelists are really renowned experts, so we're really looking forward to a good discussion today. I may ask some questions after their presentations, but we are eager to open it up to the audience for their questions. So really, without any further ado, we're going to go to our first presenter, who's Dan Blumenthal. Over to you, Dan.
Well, thank you, Bruce, and it's good to be back with the Federal Society. I was a professional member in Manhattan and a law school member at Duke Law School, so it's good. Been a while. Good to be back. So, obviously, the president is finishing up his Asia trip, and we've certainly received more information about what the administration is planning to do about North Korea. In the lead up to the trip, he, when I say lead up, I mean the past 8 months or so, they had to quickly come up with some sort of response and policy as they inherited a difficult situation on the peninsula with Kim Jong-un closer to being able to weaponize a intercontinental ballistic missile, as all of you know, and increasing the pace and tempo at which he was testing all manner and range of missile as well. So they inherited a full-blown crisis, and the initial policy response after a fairly quick review was something that they called maximum pressure and engagement. I think the maximum pressure piece was clear they were going to garner international support for squeezing the North Korea regime, both through U.N. sanctions, about which you'll hear more later, and through unilateral sanctions, as well as through trying to get countries to cut off revenue-inducing services from North Korean residents and countries around the world and other measures. So as well as the military coercion piece, where the tempo of exercises with Japan and South Korea has been fairly unrelenting as well. So the pillars of pressure, I think, have been fairly clear. The engagement part has been a little bit more incoherent as to with whom engagement is to be had, whether that's primarily with the Chinese or with Kim Jong-un himself. You know, the maximum pressure piece, I think, was being executed fairly well. The engagement diplomatic piece, I think, had some room for improvement in terms of clarity as to what end states are as well. I think the president had to do a number of things on this trip, that some of which he did, some fairly complex conversations with Prime Minister Abe of Japan, with whom he enjoys very close relations, warm relations, I should say. But there's some questions that the Japanese and the U.S. have relating to complex contingencies should North Korea really choose more provocation and conflict relating to the unity of military command, which is still a big problem among Japan, South Korea, and the United States, and also agreement on plausible and reasonable strategic endgames for for the policy, and that was a sort of behind the scenes set of talks and negotiations they had in Japan. I think when it came to the public face, the speech in the Korean National Assembly that the president made was quite powerful, a powerful challenge to the most powerful challenge I think that any president has made to just the sort of atrocities and dangers of North Korea, as well as speaking to the South Koreans themselves and ways that they can understand about their own successes and what life was like in freedom in South Korea versus darkness in North Korea. Finally there was China, a lot of rhetorical public flourishes with respect to the Xi Jinping regime that, grated, I think, on a lot of allies' ears. But, they were mostly rhetorical flourishes from what I understand. The president and his team have decided to take more risks with respect to the U.S.-China economic relationship and go after more Chinese entities and individuals, either just doing direct business or indirect business with North Korea, as than before, and I think they'll continue along that tack. They're quite clear when it comes to trade with China that they don't really care that much about risking the U.S. economic relationship with China, and particularly when there's a security interest involved. I think they, from what I understand, they had discussions with China also, as much as you can with China. China's not very forthcoming when it comes to what the vision is about the end state for the Korean Peninsula as a whole, or what their own contingency plans are, of which they have many, both military options of their own as well as other types of security options. So I doubt that that was a very robust conversation. The Chinese just won't give much when it comes to those kinds of conversations. So the key for the policy is to stay in lockstep with Japan, to try to keep, from a U.S. perspective, to try to keep Moon Jae-in, who is a progressive in Korea and wants engagement or wants more engagement with North Korea, to try to keep him, on board with a certain policy of pressure and deterrence and containment, and to try to keep China not from going in the opposite direction. I think it'll be difficult to get China to cut off entirely oil shipments and the like, but I think what the administration is coming to realize is that the only way to, quote, get China to do more, and that's not to help the United States, but is to make it so China really just views North Korea as a liability. And the way to do that is for China itself to feel more of a bite in terms of sanctions that hurt China, not just North Korea, but also to keep up the tempo of not just the tempo of military exercises with Japan and South Korea, but also new structures and alliance, trilateral alliance cooperation, not just on missile defense, but on other types of even more offensive postures that China won't like at all. And then eventually, obviously, all this needs a lot of time to work, eventually to go to China and explore the scope for diplomacy to say, have you had enough? This is obviously becoming a strategic liability for you. What should we do about Kim Jong-un? So that's one of many options, I think, that they're considering and moving towards. It's still unclear, very unclear, I would say, about whether or not they want to talk to Kim Jong-un and what about. I think, generally speaking, the policy is still moving more in the direction of tying North Korea around China's neck as a strategic liability, and then seeing if China wants to talk about how to get, you know, get rid of this liability. Why don't I stop there? I'm sure I've given others a lot to comment on or disagree or agree with and ask questions about.
No, that's great, Dan. And, you know, as you point out, is the president is having, you know, troubles trying to get China on board to go against what, you know, China's reluctance to really increase pressure. But every U.S. president has faced that same quandary. So we're going to turn to Stefan Haggard now for his comments. Stefan, over to you.
Thanks, Bruce. I just lead off by saying that I largely agree with most of what Dan said, and I'm going to fill in some of the details, taking a sort of political economy approach to the crisis and looking at what has happened on the trade and investment front and the North Korea's external sector. So if we go back to when the crisis started, which was in the fall of 2002, so this is really something that's been going on for about 15 years now, North Korea's trade was relatively diversified. About 20% went to the south under an emergent engagement strategy under the Kim Dae-jung administration, which was just winding down. 20% went to Japan, partly fueled by an expatriate community of Koreans and North Koreans in Japan. 20% with China and the remainder with the rest of the world. If we fast forward, we see that one of the perverse effects of sanctions is that North Korea is almost entirely dependent now on China. So the numbers that you see of about 90% of North Korea's trade being with China are broadly correct. And that's in part because Japan and South Korea have drifted towards a virtual embargo. In South Korea's case, with the closing of the Kaesong Industrial Complex. And Russia, despite the fact that it plays a political role in this whole process, the complementarities aren't really there for them to pick up a share of North Korea's trade that would ever be significant. So they're still at the table as one of the members of the six parties, but they don't really have the financial resources to be a player on the economic side. And the rest of the world, of course, has just seen more and more political risk on the peninsula. So that's also driven the dependence on China. Up until 2016, China's role with respect to the UN Security Council resolution process was largely to protect the North Koreans. But I think that with the test in 2016, China's view began to shift. And the big change was that in the past, UN Security Council resolutions had restricted and sanctioned North Korea's military-related trade, that is, weapons systems and also anything to do with the WMD program. But the Chinese had been reluctant to impose any sanctions on North Korea's commercial trade, and had viewed that trade as a legitimate right of North Korea to continue to conduct. And that has shifted quite dramatically with two Security Council resolutions in 2016 and then two more in 2017, the last one following the sixth test. And what I think China is doing is experimenting with how far they feel they can push the North Korean regime. They've banned the coal trade, which was a significant North Korean export. They've placed restrictions on seafood and textile exports and so on. And this is really, I think, a fairly significant change in Chinese posture towards North Korea that reflects some of the disaffection that Dan mentioned. But it's also been affected by the U.S. adoption of secondary sanctions. And you should know that the U.S. doesn't do any trade or investment with North Korea. So the question is how it can exercise leverage over North Korea indirectly. And the way it can do that is essentially by designating companies or individuals who are trading with North Korea and denying them access to the American financial system. And this was actually an authority which Congress gave President Obama back in February 2016, but he was reluctant to use it in his last year. And I think the most significant departure of the Trump policy, actually, if we set aside the tweets, is basically to add the secondary sanctions tool to the portfolio of instruments that the U.S. has been using to go after North Korea. And particularly in the executive order of about a month and a half ago now, the administration has the authority to basically designate or target any individual or firm which is doing any business with North Korea. And the Treasury is the lead agency on that, and they've been using that authority gradually to target Russian and Chinese entities that have been identified as conducting significant trade. And I think the Chinese shift in view is probably partly related to the willingness of the administration to use that instrument. Now, so the question is, how long do we have to wait before these sanctions have material effect? And here I think I'm somewhat of an outlier in the North Korean watchers community, so I'll say that, though I think the CIA agrees with me on this point, which is that the sanctions are starting to have effect. And we're not seeing that yet in economic indicators, with a few exceptions, such as rising fuel prices in Pyongyang. But we are seeing it in a host of speeches that North Korean officials have made, including Kim Jong-un himself, and recent efforts on the part of the regime to suck up foreign exchange from North Koreans that are involved in the informal markets. And this is something in particularly we've seen over the last couple of weeks. And we know from the Iranian sanctions that these sanctions don't work gradually, but they typically work when they start having an effect on the black market exchange rate. I think this was one of the crucial things that pushed the Iranians back to the negotiating table even before Rouhani had been elected. And so we watched the exchange rate and rice prices very closely, and it's not impossible that North Korea could experience a financial crisis because of the gradual constriction on its ability to access foreign exchange and the fact that the economy has become more open and that local markets depend on that openness in part for their survival. So then the question is how the North Koreans will respond to this eventuality. And there, I don't think the news is necessarily good. The fact that the sanctions are working doesn't mean that the North Koreans will automatically come back to the table. They could very well respond to this through initiating other cycles of provocation designed in part to drive wedges between the United States, China, and South Korea and Japan over these issues by getting China nervous about the prospects that the United States might act in a military fashion or deploy more assets to the region. And so there's this very delicate game here about sanctions, how we use military signaling. And the third piece, which Dan alluded to, which is how the negotiations might go forward. Now, at this juncture, the only concrete proposal that's actually on the table is a Russia-China proposal, which has been called a freeze for freeze or suspension for suspension proposal, in which the United States would suspend military exercises in return for a suspension of nuclear missile testing on the part of North Korea. And as I'm sure all of you can understand, this is not a particularly appealing proposal for the United States because it's like a blackmail proposal. You know, if you pay us, we'll stop beating you. But I'm not necessarily as opposed to it as some of my colleagues are if the Chinese can assure that the North Koreans will show up at negotiations. It's obvious that we're not going to accept a proposal of this sort without some promise or likelihood that the North Koreans would actually engage in a serious discussion of denuclearization. And that's really the missing piece at this point. China always claims that this has to be resolved by direct negotiations between the United States and China, and the North Koreans, which is fine, but the North Koreans aren't showing up. So I think at this effort, what needs to be done in part is to put a little bit more thought and muscle into exactly what these negotiations would look like. So the other part of the coercive diplomacy, that is the sanctions, which is the maximum pressure, and the engagement, which is some off-ramp for Kim Jong-un, can work more tightly in tandem. So I'll stop there and I'll pass the baton.
Great. Thanks very much, Stefan. You were able to cover a lot of territory. We'll go right now to Julian Koo. Over to you, Julian.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and I really appreciate the chance to talk about these issues. My job here is probably to sort of talk a little bit about the law, since this is a federal society. We do talk about the law sometimes in a more specific way, although I think both Stephen and Daniel gave really fascinating presentations. I want to talk a little bit about the legal implications or issues that are raised by this, some of the strategies they discussed. So, for instance, I would say with Dan, he suggested that one of the ways the U.S. is trying to put pressure on North Korea and China is sort of making noises militarily and maybe sort of giving China some reason to think that a military action by the United States is possible if the problem is not solved at some point with China's help. And on Professor Haggard's sort of comments, I think he noted, I was struck by how he noted that secondary sanctions, meaning sanctions on third-party countries like Chinese companies or Russian companies that do business in North Korea, seem to be an important way to get leverage and put pressure on North Korea. What I find interesting about both is that, legally speaking, both have some problems. In other words, threatening military action or actually taking military action against North Korea has some legal problems. There's some legal limitations or obstacles to that. And similarly, actually, secondary sanctions do have some legal problems as well under international law in particular. So let me just talk a little bit about the way international and U.S. law might intersect with some of the strategies that both of them discussed. So first, with respect to what most people think about the North Korea problem, what if the United States took some sort of military action against North Korea? And the legal framework for that is generally disfavors any unilateral action by the United States, especially taken by the president without Congress. So the U.S. Constitution famously sort of imposes a limitation on, requires congressional participation in decision to take military action. I'll just note that this is not entirely clear. We're not entirely clear which way our system works. For instance, President Bush sought congressional authorization for his invasion of Iraq and his use of force against Afghanistan after September 11th. On the other hand, President Obama did not seek similar authorization for his strike into Libya in 2013, I think my dates are wrong, nor of his expansion of the war against ISIS. And so when President Trump struck the authorized missile strikes against Syria in April after a chemical attack, he also did not get congressional authorization. So there's a bit of moving around here. I think there is some thought among lawyers who study the question that the U.S. president seems to have some authority to use force, certainly to respond to any imminent threat. And even without an imminent threat, use force short of a full-scale war without going to Congress. So Syria and Libya, he doesn't need congressional authorization for something short of a full-scale war. So I think given these precedents, it's probably the case that the U.S. Constitution will allow a U.S. strike, the president to strike North Korea's nuclear facilities with cruise missiles or bombers, but an actual invasion of North Korea, which is much closer to the Iraq example, would probably not be consistent with our current understanding of the way the Constitution limits war powers. I think the other significant body of law to think about here, and here we talk about international law, in particular the United Nations Charter, is important for a couple reasons. One, it's something every country, including the United States, has agreed to follow. But two, it's really a metric by which a lot of countries judge actions by, the legitimacy of actions by the United States. And the UN Charter limits countries to using military force only in self-defense. Now, it does allow self-defense of allies as well. And so here, the United States, I think, has a treaty obligations with South Korea and Japan, which threats against Japan and South Korea would also trigger self-defense rights, even if North Korea does not directly challenge or threaten the United States. However, the problem is, when is self-defense permitted? In general, there's agreement that if there's an imminent armed attack, you have the right to use force. But imminence is very difficult to define. Some precedent suggests that the very creation and existence of nuclear weapons are enough to satisfy the standard. Israel struck Iraq in 1986 and Syria in 2007, just simply to prevent the creation of nuclear weapons programs. But there was widespread condemnation by many countries as well on those strikes. And so I think if there was a strike against North Korea on the nuclear programs, not everyone, but a lot of countries would deem that to be a violation of the UN Charter and not satisfied by the requirement of self-defense. So now sanctions, economic sanctions of the kind that Professor Haggard was discussing, are not usually seen to be a violation or a use of force. Where there would be a problem, though, and I know this has been discussed, is to the extent the U.S. tries to use its Navy to interdict trade with North Korea, a blockade of North Korea where you stop countries from trading with North Korea by using military force, by boarding ships that try to trade in North Korea, that would actually typically be considered the use of force and would trigger the right of North Korea to start shooting back. It would be the equivalent of an act of war. So before the United States takes a step of trying to impose some sort of blockade, a military blockade, using its naval forces in North Korea, that would definitely be something that would cross the line into creating sort of a warlike situation. And North Korea would, in theory, legally be able to strike back. One other issue that has been sort of brought up a lot in North Korea is that the United States, many people in the U.S. have called for regime change, which we did with respect to Iraq as well. And a lot of people in the international community would consider that to be a violation of the international, of the UN Charter. Wouldn't go that far. The UN Charter says you're not supposed to interfere in the domestic affairs of other states. It's generally been understood that, and their territorial integrity. Regime change, sort of, if it's just advocacy of a new type of government, is not necessarily something that would violate this principle. But I would say that the Chinese have placed a great emphasis on this principle, non-interference in domestic affairs. And so we're likely to see a lot of pushback from China against even the very mention of saying our goal is to change the regime openly. Now, if it's not an openly seeking to change regime, you wouldn't get quite as much pushback. But I think, generally speaking, it's disfavored to walk around calling for a change in government openly as interfering in the domestic affairs of another country. Let me just say one last thing about the secondary sanctions. As Professor Haggard mentioned, sanctions on foreign companies, so it's like a Chinese company that's in China that's doing business in North Korea. Under current U.S. law, President Trump has the authority to prevent that country, that sort of company, from doing business with the United States. That is a very interesting type of power that has not been used up until now because it's been controversial. Basically, you're interfering, you know, a Chinese company wants to do business with Korea and it's not something banned by the U.N. Security Council. Why should the U.S. have the right to prevent a Chinese company in China from trading with North Korea? That's very close to the line where a lot of countries have considered that to be beyond interfering in the domestic affairs of other countries, but interfering with their right to control their trade with other countries. Now, the U.S. would say, well, we're just preventing them from trading with the United States as well. That's what we've tried with Cuba over many years, and it has been something Europeans have rallied around to criticize the United States as unduly interfering in Cuban affairs by, say, sanctioning a Mexican company that wants to do business with Cuba. We've done that. But Mexico and we've sanctioned European companies to try to do that. And we've got enormous blowback from European and Canadian and Mexican companies that want to do business with Cuba and don't otherwise have connections to the United States. So that's another area of possible concern. So what's interesting, I think, about this conversation is that all the great strategies, which I think Dan and Professor Haggard laid out, putting military pressure, maybe threatening regime change, imposing secondary sanctions, really are not super supported in under international law, that they kind of run against international law and certainly will be criticized as such. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do them. It does mean that we should expect a lot of blowback for these policies from countries like China and other countries down the road, because I think international law still uses a metric for measuring legitimacy of the U.S., and the U.S. needs to be ready to sort of support its actions with some reasonable legal arguments that would sort of defend what it's threatening or planning to do. So I'll stop there, and I'm sure we'll get some questions about that stuff as well.
Great. That sounds great, and all the presentations really did cover a lot of territory. Before we go to the audience questions, I did want to come back on a couple things. To Stefan, when you point out that sort of a distinguishing feature of Trump's policy from his predecessors is the secondary sanctions, and then you mentioned the new executive order, which really does sort of, you know, plow some new ground where it's not so much point target focused on people who have committed some wrongdoing, but instead it's even going after legitimate businesses. But that executive order wasn't accompanied by any, entities that were sanctioned. And, you know, if we look at the secondary sanctions or indeed the overall sanctions that the administration has done, you know, they've gone after one Chinese bank, whereas Congressman Ed Royce provided a list of 12 that he thought should be sanctioned. And there have been sort of tranches of some Chinese entities, sort of consistent with previous administrations. You know, do you think that there really is a difference in the enforcement of the sanctions between this administration and the predecessors? And maybe taking a step back is, if you remove the rhetoric, aren't there a lot of continuity or signs of continuity between Trump and the predecessors? And continuity is not a bad thing. If you're using the instruments of national power in a good way, you don't necessarily want U.S. policy to, you know, reverse course dramatically.
Well, look, let me first start at the tail end of your question and agree that rebranding is just something that incoming administrations do, whether they're Democratic or Republican. And it's pretty clear that there's a strong family resemblance between maximum pressure and engagement and strategic patience. Both of them are essentially strategies of coercive diplomacy in which sanctions and military signaling are coupled with the commitment to talk. And Secretary Tillerson in particular has been carrying the talks message, probably in most extended form in the speech he gave at the UN earlier in the year. But I agree with you completely that there isn't a huge shift in approach with respect to secondary sanctions. With respect to the overall strategy. Now, with respect to secondary sanctions, at the time the executive order was issued, no firms were designated on that day. But there have subsequently been several short lists of companies that have been identified that Treasury has designated. And I think that what's happening is that the administration has been actually quite successful at the UN Security Council itself in securing resolutions and more speedily than they did in 2016 or following earlier tests. So there's actually been some success. I think the administration can claim some success for securing China's signature on deeper resolutions at the multilateral level than they had in the past. And even if the secondary sanctions powers that are contained in the executive order aren't fully utilized, I think that China is operating under the shadow of those sanctions and is aware that the extent that it to which it can cooperate on the sanctions at the multilateral level will probably influence the extent to which the administration will pursue the secondary sanctions that Julian talked about, which, of course, the Chinese have been consistently opposed to. And so there may be some reason for the administration to hold back on the secondary sanctions if it can get cooperation with the Chinese at the multilateral level.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. I've got a long list of other questions, but I want to allow our audience to get to questions. So we'll turn it back over to our organizer and have her open it up to the audience.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode is turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. While we wait for that first question to line up, Bruce, do you have any other questions?
Yeah. Going to Dan on sort of how much has China changed? You know, it's always an uphill battle trying to get them to fully implement required UN sanctions, to try to get them to go after the Chinese entities which are violating U.S. law through money laundering and other crimes. China you know, has said a lot of good things over the years and then sort of underperformed. But, you know, recently we've had Beijing announce publicly that all of its banks and businesses will no longer engage with North Korean counterparts. Also, they've reached some kind of accommodation with South Korea about, you know, backing off of the Chinese threats and pressure against in response to South Korea allowing deployment of the THAAD missile system. You know, has China turned over a new leaf, or should we still be cynical?
Well, you know, cynicism is always a good approach with respect to China. The not that much, Bruce. I think that when it comes to the kinds of things that would really, and again, this goes back to the United States and Japan and South Korea really have to decide on what they want this course of diplomacy to look like. Do they want? Do they mean that Kim Jong-un has to go, you know, and work with China to effectuate that? Or do they mean that they're going to get into another negotiation with him? And I don't think they've fully worked that out. So China benefits from that in a sense, because they can wait out if there isn't a decided upon strategic vision for the future of the peninsula. So in that sense, there are a host of factors working for contradictory Chinese policies. You know, one is like the Chinese view the United States as its chief geopolitical rival. North Korea is doing a decent job of trying to cause some fissures in the key alliances, so why not let them do that, particularly if they succeed in having an ICBM that they can put nuclear weapons on and then create an alliance crisis, because the North Koreans or the Chinese can tell the South Koreans and the Japanese that the United States will never trade Pyongyang for Los Angeles. That's the classic alliance breaking method. So in some ways, the Chinese, you know, they like that. I mean, they wouldn't mind a broken alliance system. In other ways, to answer your question, Bruce, you know, they still don't see it, the Korea problem, as a big threat to them. Yes, you know, they see problems with instability and with, you know, refugees and all the rest of it, but they don't think those nuclear weapons have to do with them. And the only way that they will change their mind is if all of a sudden they see North Korea as a risk, a liability, something that's causing the alliances to change in real substantive ways, that they're changing their structure so that they're actually operating more NATO-like in their nuclear postures, in their offensive and moving to more offensive postures and their missile defense postures, you know, then, you know, you can turn to the Chinese and say, why, you know, this is what's happening. Everything's on the table in terms of the way we're reposturing these three alliances. Is this what you want to live with? If not, let's talk. But for right now, we're not there yet. I don't know if we will get there, but if we do get there, then we'll have the kind of leverage that I think we all want with the Chinese to say, let's talk about a different kind of future for the peninsula.
Great. Okay, do we have an audience question?
We do. Let's go to our first audience question.
Mary Maxwell here in the Boston chapter. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I understand that one of the sources of law in international law is state practice, but emphatically not state practice as the source of constitutional law. So if we have Trump making a strike on Syria or Obama in Libya, that does not change Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Do you agree?
I guess that's for me.
It certainly sounds like one for you.
Yeah. So you're right. I agree totally. It doesn't change it. However, there is no definitive case law. This has been a conundrum. There's no the Supreme Court or even lower courts have never interpreted Article 1, Section 8, the clause which requires Congress to be the one to declare war. So what we have is a lot of opinions from scholars and then from the Justice Department. And the sources they look are, is to look at the actions of Congress and the president as an effort to using executive practice or congressional practice as a way to interpret parts of the Constitution which have not been interpreted by the courts. And so there's been a lot of debate over what Article 1, Section 8 means, Congress declaring war. And so that's why I think, the opinions and actions, and here, since it's very hard for this to go to court, it probably does make sense to look at the views of the Justice Department and the views of the president and the actions of the president, because that's an important source for each. The president himself has an obligation to follow the Constitution and interpret the Constitution and obey the Constitution. So he will ask for a legal opinion from his advisors before he acts, hopefully, and have done so in the past. And that's some of the sources I looked at, which is, I think, this distinction between war and not war has been something that's evolving in executive branch opinions and practice probably the last 20 years or so.
There's plenty of jurisprudence before 1952 up to the Steele-Mills case. And since then, there have been many litigants, including myself, in Maxwell v. Bush, that have simply had their cases dismissed. So you can't really say that the lack of jurisprudence, that is the jurisprudence.
Right, but I think that the lack of jurisprudence means that you have to look for other sources, right? And there are lots of areas of the Constitution, not just this one, which have not been interpreted by the courts. And so,
this one has been interpreted by the courts. It's clear. It's settled law.
I don't think it is settled law. I don't think any definitive court decision has decided exactly what constitutes a war and when Congress needs to be involved and when Congress doesn't have to be involved. I think those decisions have not been resolved, and certainly not at the U.S. Supreme Court level, but even at the lower courts have been divided. So I really don't think that this issue has been resolved definitively by the courts or, frankly, by the executive branch either.
Okay. Do we have another audience question?
We do not. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Well, then, as we wait, if I could go to Dean Koo. The idea of a preventive attack, being different from retaliatory or preemptive, is certainly an issue that seems new. President Trump and some advisors have said a number of things that seem to be indicative of that. And, that really has been an issue that's been, what we say, sucking the air out of the room here in Washington and in my interaction with Korean and Japanese colleagues. But I want to go on the blockade. I understand that, the way the UN resolutions have been done is they've given authority sort of Chapter 7, Article 41 authority, where no one is allowed to interdict North Korean ships, even if we think that they are carrying contraband in violation of the resolutions, and that, the U.S. occasionally has been pushing for a Clause 42, which would give, say, law enforcement or navies or Coast Guard authority on the high seas to inspect cargo that a North Korean freighter, may be carrying that is perceived to be in violation. If the resolutions had that clause, would either a blockade to enforce inspections be legal, or would it allow for interdiction on the high seas?
Yeah, no, you raise a good point. I think a resolution would have to specifically authorize this. Right now, what we have is this kind of weird consent regime. So before you board a vessel or interdict a vessel, you have to get consent from the flag state, right? The ship has the flag of some country. And so if they get consent, and sometimes the U.S. has been able to get sort of pre-consent from some of these countries to say, oh, you can board it, then you can board it. And so it's really – and if the U.N. specifically authorized it, then it would be the equivalent of the use of force, right? And you could interdict vessels even if the flag state did not consent. So, for instance, one of the big ones, a North Korean flag vessel, in theory, U.N. could authorize – the Security Council could authorize that kind of interdiction. They haven't done so because it's tantamount to authorizing the use of force, which is a big deal, which is why countries have been hesitant to allow the U.S. to do that. And so what we have so far is this sort of we really can't board North Korean vessels or vessels of countries which haven't given us consent.
Okay, and that's why we've had sort of these slow boat chases with a U.S. naval vessel kind of following at 5 knots or so a North Korean freighter, and sometimes the freighter's simply gone all the way back to North Korea.
Right, and that's, and I think it's a big, I mean, it's a big issue. I mean, I think that, you know, I think the U.N., this is another step for China to consider. And the U.S. Navy is very scrupulous on these rules, and so they're not going to violate the rules. But it is something that allows a lot of sort of leakage in the sanctions.
Right. Okay, do we have an audience question?
We do not.
All right, well then
if
let me...
If we don't, could I ask Julian a question? Since this is a federalist society, I thought I might take advantage of the legal expertise. Julian, there have been a couple of Office of Legal Counsel opinions. The first, the post 9/11 opinion in September 2001, and then I think another one concerning Iraq, that appeared to grant the president a fair amount of discretion with respect to going after terrorists. And I'm just wondering whether those opinions have had any influence on this Article 1, Article 2 tension in the Constitution about the powers of the president to initiate military action.
Right. So I think, there's been back and forth on this one. I think, the Congress did authorize, to go after anyone connected to September 11th. But there was also broader theories of Article 2 authority that the president should have a general authority to go after anyone who is posing an imminent threat to the United States. But in general, this authority is this general, what we call just invoking the Constitution without seeking authority from Congress to go after terrorists. This authority has not been used. In other words, every terrorist the U.S. has used military force against is in theory related somehow to Al-Qaeda or any group that was affiliated with the groups that were responsible for the 9/11 attacks or consequently related to Iraq, the Iraq resolution. So Congress authorized us to go into Iraq. Things related to that, we can use force. Same thing with September 11th. They've stretched it really far to include ISIS, but at least in theory, it draws back to that. There are people who believe, and there's opinion, like as you noted, that says, actually, the president doesn't even need to go to Congress to go after terrorists of any kind. That authority has not been exercised either by President Bush or by President Obama or by President Trump, but it certainly is a lurking theory out there that could be invoked in a future situation. But in general, as lawyers would always advise their clients, if you have legal authority from Congress, why test the bounds by trying to invoke based purely on the Constitution, which is definitely more controversial.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah. Do we have a question?
We do not. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Okay. Yeah, if I could go back to Dan, and maybe this is kind of retreading some ground, but to get China on board, a number of experts have said, well, we really can't do anything more. We plead with them, we implore, try to beg them, or pressure them. But is another lane in the road simply imposing more secondary sanctions, like going using U.S. law? Because as these entities or other foreign entities are basically walking into U.S. banks, either in person or digitally through their correspondent accounts, in essence, sort of like, hi, I'm here to money launder, but up until now, I've really had de facto immunity because I'm Chinese and the U.S. government has been reluctant to sanction Chinese entities. Can we simply go after some of these Chinese violators, whether it's fining the big banks or designating as primary money laundering concerns the medium and lower banks or businesses? But if we make clear to Beijing, it's like we're not saying the Chinese government is complicit. We're simply enforcing the law against those entities which are coming into our financial system. Now, would that, do you think, get sort of, would China sort of say, yeah, you're right, go ahead and do it? Or do you think China would respond? Some have feared a trade war if we were to actually go after, say, the big four banks of China or to go after a more extensive list, rather than a smaller group each time.
Thanks, Bruce. Yeah, I mean, there's really no other way to get China to change its risk calculus. and therefore its strategy. There's no convincing China to, quote, help us. There's only convincing China that the current policy on North Korea that they have is riskier than a change in policy. Certainly the plan of Secretary Clinton's people, should she have won the election last year, was to copy essentially the level of Iranian sanctions and you know what they called crippling sanctions. And again, I don't know the legal basis for this. I do know this about the Chinese economy, and wrote about this with my colleague Derek Scissors in the Wall Street Journal, that it's a bit of a shell game. You know, the industries that do a lot of the major business in North Korea, let's say mining, oil, energy, you know, get so many Chinese Communist Party subsidies as it is, you know, they're just sort of moving those subsidies around to say to protect the big, you know, to protect the big guys from sanctions. It would no doubt be a risk for the United States to start to go after China, and of course we are now the number one recipient of Chinese foreign direct investment in the world, so there's a lot more accounts and so forth to go after. There's no doubt there would be a risk that the Chinese would react. Of course, there's that risk. But I personally don't see, since we don't want to go to war with North Korea, another option besides to up the level of risk, up our risk acceptance with respect to China on secondary sanctions, on much bigger lists of people who would be sanctioned, on redesignated North Korea. It would help to redesignate North Korea as a terrorist entity. It would help to bring back some of the initiatives that we had in 2002 to 2004 that treated North Korea more or less like a criminal entity than as a state, obviously. It would help in terms of our bases, at least our diplomatic bases, for some of these actions. But, Bruce, I see no other option besides economic coercion of China feeling the economic bite of U.S. course of diplomacy with respect to North Korea, feeling both the economic bite as well as the security encirclement. I see no other option than China feeling that, and then allowing the time for those measures to take place and for China to absorb the direction of U.S. policy, and then exploring with China the scope for diplomacy to have something else on the peninsula.
Right, and several times we've heard state sponsors of terrorism, and there's some hints or at least perceptions that the administration may return North Korea to the state sponsors of terrorism list. That decision to either do so or not do so is actually a week or so overdue. It's a congressional deadline. Some had thought that President Trump might announce that return to the terrorism list either during his stop in Tokyo, since he had met with families of the abductees, those Japanese citizens kidnapped by North Korea in the 70s and 80s, or during that the National Assembly speech that Dan mentioned, where he went into, you know, a long description, I think a very powerful description, of the nature of the North Korean regime and in its human rights violations, which a UN Commission of Inquiry concluded in 2014 are so systemic and wide scale that they constitute crimes against humanity. So I thought sort of a missed opportunity in both countries, but perhaps the president saying he will have a big announcement about North Korea when he gets back home, perhaps that's it. Well, we don't know yet.
Yeah, I think that's right, Bruce. I mean, I think they have to come back after this very long and you know, substantive trip. They have to come back and decide on as we say in Washington, what the do outs and takeaways are. The agencies have to get back to huddle up again and say, you know, these are the four or five things that we now have to take action on with respect to North Korea, and then of course some of the other issues in Asia.
Right, and some will have a question about whether it would actually have sort of new sanctions authority or impose additional things. I think that really the government has, you know, a broad spectrum of authorities. It's just successive administrations have, in my view, underutilized them. But, you know, I think it would have an impact on, you know, what I would describe as a third track in the road, to mangle an analogy, is, you know, if the first track is sort of the trying to get stronger enforcement of UN resolutions, the second is international and U.S. law, and the third is going after even legitimate business partners, where if you add the stigma of crimes against humanity, you know, slave labor conditions, purveyor and sponsor of terrorism, it just really adds impetus for banks and businesses to really not want to have their reputation linked to, you know, such a heinous regime.
That's exactly right. And of course, the way we talk about North Korea to other countries and the way we treat its diplomats and all the rest of it. But I think you're absolutely right. The moral legitimacy question is a powerful one.
Right.
Can I just jump in here, though? I'm sorry, just quickly.
Yeah, no, please, go ahead.
The problem is that, as Steve mentioned, now North Korea has most of its trades with China. And China is uniquely immune to that sort of moral pressure. I mean, I think other countries are more likely to be able to be sort of pressured on that. But I think if China is the key to the North Korea on the economic front, and I think that type of has the least amount of leverage against China, the human rights concerns, the state-sponsored terrorism, they do business with all sorts of terrible countries, and it's not going to bother them.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's, you know, why some of us have been recommending, you know, going after more of the Chinese violators of, you know, we've imposed $12 billion in fines on European banks for money laundering for Iran, and we haven't imposed a penny in fines on any Chinese bank. So if you were to go after, say, the big four with sort of comparable fines, they're paying a price. It could have an impact on their decision making. You know, we've known in the past that the U.S. action or the threat of U.S. action can actually get Chinese entities to do things that the Chinese government doesn't want them to do. And we saw that with the Bank of China back in 2005, 2006, when because of the threat of U.S. sanctions, sort of, you know, indirect, you know, as opposed to actions taken against Banco Delta Asia. But we know the Bank of China defied the Chinese government, who wanted the bank to continue engaging with North Korea. And the Bank of China said, for our own continued existence, you know, and so we don't face threats under Section 311 of the Patriot Act, we've got to cut off North Korea. And so we were able to influence a major Chinese bank even to defy the Chinese government. So I think some of the actions, you know, can result from if you start going after some of the Chinese banks and businesses, it can influence more of them away from dealing with North Korea, regardless of what Beijing wants. Well, with that said, do we have any audience questions?
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Looks like we do not. So would you all like to do some? Oh, we do have a question, so we'll do this one really quick. Go ahead, caller. You might be on mute.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. What is the value of at least the ability to talk force, to have force in the arsenal, to have force as an option?
Would that be sort of the U.S. attacking North Korea for its violations of the UN resolutions?
It would be, as far as what's been discussed already and what, for example, former Ambassador John Bolton would be talking about, what President Trump is saying, when it's a matter of all cards are on the table, period.
Bruce, can I
attempt
on that one?
Yeah, yeah. I think we're talking the preventative attack option.
Well, if I can answer that more in terms of There are no good preventative attack options, and the Pentagon made that clear, I think, last week. You know, preventative attack options really require, frankly, the kind of military we don't have anymore, because the budget's been cut so many times. But you know, the kind of ground forces you would need to find and hold territory and so forth. That said, you know, the ability to threaten retaliation, work even more closely with the South Koreans and the Japanese, and both are going to be moving to somewhat more offensive postures to defend themselves or have retaliatory capacities, the ability to use, you know, all manner of overt unconventional capabilities, from special forces to cyber and so on, to really keep the regime on its toes. There's no overstating the necessity of that for diplomacy to work. But Mr. Trump and the Congress need to do as they promised and up the our own defense budget in order to maintain this pace of course of exercises that we're doing right now around the peninsula.
Great. Thank you, Dan. And I think that'll probably bring us to an end. I think we're out of time.
Thank you all for joining us. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.